Hello, it's Chloe here from World Have Your Say. Thank you for downloading the podcast for the programme, which was broadcast on Friday, the 3rd of March, 2017. We began the programme speaking to three journalists who've worked in China, talking about the challenges they face, the restrictions. After one of the most watched videos on the BBC website today was the moment when a BBC TV crew was attacked when they were trying to interview a woman in a remote Chinese village. We spent around 20 minutes talking about that. Then I spoke to a football journalist in Argentina, because footballers this weekend won't be playing any matches. They are unhappy that they haven't been paid bonuses, and so they're effectively downing tools and won't be playing games. We also heard from a pretty fed up Argentinian football fan. Then the second half of the programme, a really moving conversation with a young man in Mosul who has recently been liberated by the Iraqi army, was living for 2.5 years under so-called Islamic State control, and he used to use his phone to contact his fiancée, something which was incredibly dangerous because people were beheaded if they were found to be using their phone, but that was the way he stayed in touch with her. And then for the final 15 minutes of the programme, we spoke to people who live with sickle cell disease. This is because of a revolutionary new treatment which is looking at potentially curing the disease. We also spoke to the lead scientist on that. Hope you enjoy the programme. Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Chloe Tilley. We're live for the next hour. In the second half of the programme, we're going to play you a conversation I had about half an hour ago with a young man in Mosul in northern Iraq. He's recently been liberated from so-called Islamic State. He lived under their rule for over 2 years, but a revived Iraqi army has driven them out. He dared to contact his fiancée by phone despite knowing the risks. Well, we'll hear his story. We'll also hear from people who live with sickle cell disease after doctors used a technique to reverse the condition in a French teenager. And fans tell us what they make of the Argentinian football strike this weekend, all over unpaid wages. But first, our correspondent John Sudworth and his BBC team were attacked by local government thugs in central China. They were trying to interview a villager who's a petitioner or someone fighting for justice. They were injured, they had their cameras broken, and were then forced to sign a confession for trying to conduct an illegal interview. Well, it's the most watched story on the BBC website, and we're going to spend the next 20 minutes or so speaking to journalists who've worked in China about the challenges of working there as a reporter. I'm pleased to say sitting opposite me here in the World Have Your Say studio is Mark McKinnon, who worked in Beijing between 2008 and 2013 as China correspondent for the Globe and Mail. He's now their senior international correspondent. And also Melissa Chan, who's a freelance journalist with Global Reporting Centre in Canada, who was expelled for her reporting in China. Welcome both of you to the programme. Melissa, first of all, explain to us how and why you were expelled.
I actually don't know, and that's part of the strategy of the Chinese government. In many ways, they try to keep you guessing. I certainly have my suspicions, and I think the answer is that it was a combination of factors. They certainly weren't happy with the way Al Jazeera English was reporting when it came to human rights. Of course, I think it's important to emphasize that that was not the only kind of coverage that we gave China. But in terms of our human rights reporting, they were getting a bit peeved over the years. And I think the climate, in hindsight, if we look at my departure and what happened subsequently with the Chinese government getting in a fight with the New York Times, also not allowing a Reuters correspondent, Paul Mooney, to get his visa, that the political climate had shifted right around the time I left in 2012.
How were you expelled?
Well, it was a de facto expulsion. So in other words, they didn't pick me up and put me on a plane, drag me out of my apartment, nothing dramatic like that. But if you're a correspondent based in China, you go through the annual process of renewing your journalist visa. And I had done that as a permanent journalist based in China for 4 years beforehand. And on the fifth and final try, they didn't give me my annual visa and instead sort of wanted to talk to me and then my bosses and express unhappiness first with a documentary that Al Jazeera English aired that I was not involved with. But in subsequent conversations, it seemed like a whole host of other issues they were unhappy with sort of built up. And we certainly tried to negotiate, and my editors tried to negotiate. And in the end, they gave me a two-month visa. So I was able to stay on for a little bit longer. But when that went up for renewal, I got another one-month visa. So they're giving me a tighter and tighter leash. And in the end, it got to a point where it's very clear, and I called the foreign ministry and said, you know, I'm going to outstay my visa or I need to get on a plane. And I had to get on a plane. And from my editor's point of view, they decided to go ahead and call it an expulsion. And that's what they considered it.
Mark, what are your experiences?
I didn't get expelled at, as Melissa did, but I had the same experience of being left wondering at the end of the year when you go to renew your visa, which is attached to your ability to live in China, where I was just left wondering if I was going to be allowed to live in this country for another year, and you get up to December 29th, December 30th, you're canceling your Christmas plans. So there's an obvious way that they can put pressure on people. If you want to be able to plan your Christmas next year, if you want to be able to not have to move in a real hurry, you have to sort of be seen as one of the good reporters. And there was a year where, a couple of years where I was seen as one of the more difficult reporters, specifically because I reported on an issue involving corruption that touched on the Public Security Bureau. And the Public Security Bureau controls not the visas, but controls the residence permits. So because my reporting was pointing at how retired security officers were making some side money, my life became very difficult.
I want to bring in Peter Ford as well, who's just joined us. He was Beijing Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor for 10 years up until 2016 and is now their Global Affairs Correspondent, joining us from Paris. Peter, Mark and Melissa were just sharing their experiences. What challenges did you find working in Beijing?
Hello. Well, I'm sure I didn't hear what they said, but I'm sure the challenges I faced were very much the ones that they did. I mean, fundamentally, the challenge you face is the government doesn't want you to know anything that it doesn't want you to know. And they go to extraordinary lengths, both at the central level and particularly at local government level, to stop you seeing things that might embarrass them. And I think when I was in China, I was president of the Foreign Correspondents Club of China for 3 years. And the real problem we had was that the central government had passed a lot of new regulations for the Olympics in 2008, to comply with the IOC regulations and to show it was free. And they allowed us to go out of Beijing without minders. They allowed us to talk to whoever we wanted to, who consented to talk to us. But in reality, after a year or so, that just wasn't happening. And the central government never, ever supported us against thugs from the local governments who were stopping us reporting. They were always on the side of the thugs and never on the side of the journalists, which was not perhaps that surprising.
And was there a difference, I mean, this is to all of you, between reporting in a city like in Beijing or in the case of John Sudworth when he was sort of out in a village?
Yes, going out into the countryside, I mean, the other two, my colleagues will have their experiences, but it's certainly true that one is more vulnerable in villages because one is more visible. And if they haven't actually seen you coming or heard you coming because they've been tapping your telephones or watching the train stations and the airports, in a small village, you don't escape notice. And basically, they can do what they want with you when you're down there because you're pretty much out of touch.
I had a fascinating experience in 2009 after there were some very violent riots in Xinjiang, in the city of Urumqi, where I think 60 people or so were killed. And in the aftermath, they allowed sort of foreign journalists to come to Urumqi where the violence had happened, but it was a very controlled atmosphere. We were all in the same hotel and you know, pretty much forced to file from the same room even. So after about 48 hours, they decided to move on and to go to the city of Kashgar, where they were in the process of demolishing the old city there and sort of building a Chinese city on top of what had previously been a Uyghur city. And just to explain sort of the local anger, and I got there late the afternoon one day and I did a little bit of reporting, but I woke up the next morning, there were five policemen in my hallway demanding basically taking me to the airport and expelling me from the city. And when I called to Beijing, to the foreign ministry, they were like, no, you are absolutely allowed to be there. And then when I called to Urumqi, where the sort of local setup was, they said, no, they've made a mistake. And when I tried to put them on the phone with the official in Kashgar, he literally just hung up the phone on these other officials. He said, I'm in charge here. And I was put on a plane to Urumqi.
Peter, right, I could hear Peter laughing in the background.
Well, yes, I mean, I can just see the scene. Fundamentally, the problem in China is that the lowliest policeman is more powerful than the most senior official in any other ministry. Public security, and when it comes down to it, public security rules.
Do come in, Melissa.
Right. It's really funny. We're sort of swapping stories about our experiences. I mean, following on what Mark said about his experience in Xinjiang. It is a very sensitive region for the Chinese, and I remember going to three separate cities there, Kashgar, Urumqi, and Khotan, and we were followed for the entire 9 days of our trip by two vehicles with four men in each vehicle. So every time we stopped anywhere, one of them would hop out and sort of follow us, essentially, and made it impossible to speak to anyone. And just going back to the incident that happened with the BBC team, because I worked as a television broadcast correspondent as well, going into these villages is particularly tricky if you've got so much video gear. It attracts even more attention. And we got to the point where we were playing these cat and mouse games where we would drive into a village at, say, 6 a.m. in the morning just as the sun was coming up so we could film, because you need the daylight to film. And then we sort of gave ourselves about 2 hours before somebody will show up and get us in trouble and stop our reporting. So it was sort of in and out. And it was generally successful, but there were certainly times where we were not successful, ran out of time, and had sort of these thugs like the crew in Hunan experience that same thing with people showing up in their plain clothes or their hired hands. They don't show their credentials and you can't identify them, and it gets really tricky.
The other bit of context, I thought, for what happened to John might be that is the timing of it, right before the National People's Congress every year. And you know, just the level of security, the level of paranoia just ticks up around these major dates. And I'm sure all of us have stories, maybe a lot of the people listening have heard or seen these every year on June 4th, the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square killings. You would see the square flooded with these plainclothes policemen who would go to absurd lengths to keep people from turning a camera on, sticking umbrellas in front of television cameras, and I saw one person just trying to light a candle, and she got tackled before the candle even hit the plaza. So I thought when I read what happened to John, the two things that stuck out are, he's in a small provincial center, and secondly, it's right before the NPC.
Because of the stories you're telling, do you end up almost self-censoring or restricting what you do, or does it almost become like a game of cat and mouse?
Well, I think to a certain extent you...
Go ahead, Melissa, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that I think to a certain extent you time your reports sometimes in terms of when you release them. I would like to think that I tried not to self-censor myself, but I certainly would think about when to do a certain story and when we might be able to go into a village. For example, around Chinese New Year, it gets a little bit quiet. Even the government officials start taking their time off. So that's actually a really good time to travel and go to the rural areas if you can arrange the interviews, because I think there's slightly less monitoring. That's how we managed to go to the village where current President Xi Jinping had spent some time. I think you have to play these cat and mouse games for sure.
I think there is a sense, I'm sad to say it, in which the government's efforts to restrict foreign journalists do pay off. And I don't know that I call it self-censorship, but it depends on a medium's resources and how much money they've got to spend. But certainly when I was sitting in Beijing and I heard of something happening in Xinjiang, which sounded interesting, but I knew how much time and money it would take to get there. And I also knew that the chances of my getting anything at all were basically nil, because as soon as I arrived, I'd be surrounded by people who were following, which make it impossible to interview anybody. It certainly makes you think several times about the cost effectiveness of your reporting and whether you'd be better off going somewhere else. I think one has to acknowledge that. It's depressing, but it's true.
Do you find yourself having to go, Mark, to extraordinary lengths to be able to meet with certain people so that you don't meet the authorities and prevent you from having these conversations?
I remember once I was doing a report in a town near Shenzhen, near the border with Hong Kong, and I was investigating a series of disappearances. I think there had been 23 young children under the age of five, if I remember correctly, all of whom had disappeared, most of whom were boys, and had tried to arrange interviews. And we'd set up our interviews with four of them, again, using telephones that perhaps we should have assumed were tapped or being listened to, or maybe their devices were being listened to. And by the time we got down there, all four families we'd made arrangements with had been sort of taken out of the city and taken to their family homes, shall we say, I guess what they're called, where their relatives lived, and sort of kept there until we left Shenzhen. You know, so here we are. These are families of people who've had their children abducted, and now the police are effectively abducting them to keep them from talking to us. At the end of the day, we just spoke to them by telephone, and it ended up being, you know, making it look as though the police were somehow complicit in all this. So you do push through. It doesn't always work the way they expect it to. But I think, you know, the same, we all could tell tales as well of, you know, trying to do reporting around Tibet and how absurd that got.
Peter, did you have to go to extraordinary lengths?
I don't know how extraordinary they are. I mean, I would quite often, especially in the countryside, go and see people in the middle of the night, because even secret policemen go to bed. And it was sometimes possible to get through into a village and to get to a person who you were looking for at 2 o'clock in the morning when it wouldn't have been at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But as Mark was saying, the trouble is that if our phones aren't bugged, and most of them are, even if we get hold of a phone that we're not normally using so it isn't bugged, the telephones belonging to people in what they call sensitive situations or circumstances generally are bugged. So it's very difficult to communicate over the telephone without someone hearing.
And here I feel bad for Melissa. As she said earlier, it's just so much harder to do these things on television. I remember sort of meeting in, you know, sort of curtained off back rooms of tea houses, which is fine if all you have to bring is a notebook and a pen. But when you're showing up with a television crew and cameras, it's a different game, isn't it?
It is, although I would say that I did have one advantage, which is that I'm ethnically Chinese. So in some ways, I could sneak in to places. And in particular, one story that I think about was an extreme example of the enforcement of the one-child policy, where there was a woman who was in her third trimester who was essentially beaten until her child was, well, she had to abort her child, and she was in the hospital at that time. And this was the one time where I didn't bring in my colleague, the cameraman, who was not Chinese, but my producer and myself. We walked into the hospital as if we were visiting relatives. We brought in our little camera, and we were able to get the footage and the interview that way. So, you know, going back to my departure, I think one thing that really irked the Chinese officials is the fact that I could sneak around.
And how does it compare to other countries to operate in?
I actually think that China is one of the worst or most difficult places to work in. And I worked before I lived in Russia for several years, in the Middle East for several years. And I remember flying in 2012 to cover the protests in Moscow against Vladimir Putin. And I was based in China, but we didn't have a correspondent in Moscow at the time. So I was flown over from Beijing. And I spent several days covering the protests in the center of Moscow, where you saw sort of tens of thousands of people chanting, you know, Russia without Putin. And, you know, the police were there, but quite restrained. And afterwards, I was sitting with the Moscow press corps, and they were, you know, complaining about the dictatorship that they worked in. And I sat there thinking, we just watched tens of thousands of people stand in the middle of the capital city chanting for the fall of the regime, and we tweeted about it. I mean, you wouldn't have had this gathering in China. You wouldn't have been able to tweet it. There wouldn't have, you know, the police would not have been as restrained as they were. So, you know, these words like dictatorship get thrown around, but there is actually sort of some important nuances between these different regimes. And I think China is, it's not quite North Korea, but it's, you know, in terms of how it deals with foreign press, it's at the extreme end.
And I think there's a broader aspect of this whole question of how difficult it is to work. It's not just thugs in villages stopping you talk to somebody who wants to talk to you. It's the atmosphere of fear that the government has thrown over the whole of intellectual society. I mean, the last 2 or 3 years, it's human rights lawyers who've been rounded up. It's academics who've been warned not to talk about sensitive issues with foreigners. It's harder and harder. I mean, I've been gone for a year, but as in the year before I left, it was harder and harder to find intellectuals, lawyers, people who knew what was going on, people who would talk to you about issues, who were ready to talk as the way they had been previously, because they were just simply, they'd been cowed. They'd been cowed by government threats as to what might happen to them if they said the wrong thing. And so it was safer for them not to talk to anybody. And human rights lawyers have been a particularly hard-hit bunch. And they were always, of course, quite a good source of information for what was happening, because they had their fingers on the pulse. Now, a great many of them are in jail, and those who aren't, there are all too few of them who are ready to talk openly.
Peter Ford, thank you ever so much for coming on to World, Have You Say. Thank you also to Mark McKinnon and to Melissa Chan sharing their experiences of working as journalists in China. You're listening to World Have Your Say, and spare a thought now for Argentina's football fans this weekend. Their league has produced, well, let's think how many, Lionel Messi, Diego Maradona, but top professionals are now on strike over millions of dollars in unpaid wages. It's part of a dispute over money for TV broadcast rights, and the players say they're owed up to 5 months unpaid salary. Let's speak to Daniel Edwards, who's a football journalist for Buenos Aires Herald and Goal, and speaking to us from there now. So, Daniel, just explain to us how much is unpaid and why.
Hi there, good afternoon. The figure at the moment which is in discussion is 350 million pesos, which is about $20 million. This is a compensation fee which is pledged from the government to the club directors and to compensate the end of the previous TV deal, which was funded by the government. The problem is now that the players feel that this is just not enough to get them back on the field. With all this uncertainty, the vast majority of players haven't been paid in 2017. In some extreme cases, there are individuals that haven't received wages for the last 6 months, and the stance of the players' trade union at the moment is that as long as they haven't got this money in their accounts and they haven't been fully reimbursed for the first 3 months of the year, they won't be taking the field.
Daniel, let's have a listen to one football fan who got in touch with us via WhatsApp.
Hi, I'm Fabio from Córdoba, Argentina. I think the footballers deserve to get paid. Even though some of the teams are paid, are being paid, most of the others not. So altogether, not going to play is a really good decision. They deserve to get paid because it's a job like someone else's job. In order to attend into the match, actually, I spend my time watching European football, and that's it. I'm not going to die for the Argentinians. They're full of mess, full of lies. So I really don't care if I don't go to the match.
So that's Fabio's perspective. Daniel, is that sort of summing up generally what Argentinian football fans are feeling? They're pretty fed up with their players and their clubs?
I think that's a fairly decent general view of the situation. The perception in Argentina is that the clubs run, in the vast majority of cases, corruptly. The Argentine Football Association is run in a very incompetent and corrupt way. For the last almost a year, the last 9 months, it's been under FIFA intervention. So there's no elected president. The last election ended in farcical circumstances when the vote to choose the next president ended with a 38-38 draw between only 75 voters. And that sort of sums up the entire situation. There's a feeling that no one's in charge, no one's putting their neck out on the line to protect players or coaches or even fans in the case of stadium violence and the influence of hooligan groups, which are very, very active in the country.
So a huge number of issues, Daniel, that all of Argentinian football needs to tackle, not only this problem of unpaid wages to those players, $20 million unpaid, and that is why the players are refusing to play in the league tomorrow. Many fans pretty fed up about that. Don't go anywhere. 30 minutes of World Have Your Say still to come after the news. Okay. Hello, welcome back to World Have Your Say. Chloe Tilly here with you today. We're going to be talking about sickle cell disease a little bit later on with people who are suffering from it. Many of you are clicking on this story about the success of a new DNA therapy for the disease. We'll explain what it is, what it's like to live with the condition, and what sort of hope this treatment could give. But first of all, let's head to Mosul in the north of Iraq. It's one of the biggest prizes for the forces of so-called Islamic State. They captured the city in June 2014 as the Iraqi army crumbled. IS fighters set their sights on Baghdad and dreamed of re-establishing the caliphate across Iraq and Syria. Well, 2.5 years on, it's a very different story. A revived Iraqi army is driving IS out of Mosul street by street, backed by US air power. And the traumatised people of the city are beginning to return to their neighbourhoods and to rebuild their lives. Well, an hour or so ago, I spoke to Muammar, who lives in a liberated part of Mosul, and he started by telling me what life under IS was like.
It wasn't easy at all. Of course, it was a very difficult life. In fact, we suffered a lot for almost like 2.5 years. A lot of nonsense rules that people have to obey. And actually, we didn't really have the opportunity to say no for many of these rules, although we do not really want to obey them. But being surrounded or captured in the city and not able to do anything was the real problem for the majority of people in here. So people had no choice just to obey or probably these rules that probably most of the people all around the world heard about some of them.
Well, explain those rules to us.
Well, a lot of rules that I cannot really, the list is endless. And I mean, starting with the men should grow beards and no communication is allowed, like you are not allowed to be using a mobile phone or whatever. The internet at the very beginning was restricted. Then it was banned as well, communication at all. I don't know, there were a lot of nonsense rules that you can count, like, we just didn't really have the right to say no for these rules.
And what was the penalty if you did use a mobile phone?
Beheading was, the ghost hunting the city for a long period of time. I mean, for example, if you are caught with a mobile phone or something, you would rather be accused of communicating with outsiders, people outside the city, and you are not faithful to the city, and you would rather face death, probably beheading.
And did Islamic State militants come around to your house to check if you were obeying these rules?
They were here and there in different areas. They used to check on the rules they issue. So they would rather force people to obey these rules. But some people kept themselves home just in order not to be in contact with these people.
How did it affect your life? Did you dare to go out or did you stay at home?
At the very beginning, I used to go to work. Then I lost my job. So I stayed at home for most of the time. I used to spend the time reading or do some stuff on the computer. I started sometimes writing short stories about what is happening. I don't know. It was a really, really dark period of my life.
And during this time, you were separated from your fiancé, weren't you?
I used to visit her one day a week, probably sometimes one visit, 2 weeks. I managed to use the mobile phone secretly just to send a message to tell her that I'm okay after certain airstrikes taking place in my neighborhood. And she used to do the same when there are some airstrikes in her neighborhood. And yeah, we managed to contact each other, but we were very precautious about using the mobile phone.
What effect has this had on you as a person?
Actually, now I feel like I survived, but it wasn't easy. Now, a lot of lessons were learned through this period of time. I actually do believe that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and that's the way I feel right now. I know it has been like hell for a long period of time, but I feel like I'm now stronger than before. There were some moments when you feel like there is no end for this and you feel like this dark would rather never end. But I kept the faith by saying that Mosul belongs to Mosuli people, to us. Those people are not Mosuli. They are not. They do not belong here. And there would come a change. And here we are.
Explain to people listening around the world the moment that you realised you were free, that the Iraqi army had come to your city of Mosul and liberated it.
That is just such a touching moment that you cannot probably describe easily the words.
But where were you when you?
I was in my house. I was in my house with my father and mother. Unfortunately, my brother and sister were displaced by those bad people to another area. But 40 days after the day I was liberated, they got liberated too. And the last one of my family who was under IS control was my fiancé, who eventually got liberated too.
And what was the first thing you did when you were liberated?
I shaved my beard.
And what did that feel like?
Well, it felt like the old me is getting back. That's real me. This is the way I want to be. So, no one has the right to tell me what to do and what not to do. This is my life, and I have the right to live it the way I want.
And my final question, when are you getting married?
Yeah, let's say in 2017, for sure. probably I'm just waiting for the other side of the city to be liberated. So I cannot feel the joy, and the other part of the city is still in dark, and there are a lot of people. My people are suffering in there. I don't give myself the right to be celebrating and having fun while the other part of the city is living in those people control, under those people control. I've been there and I know how it feels now. People are facing death. People are facing a hunger. People are we keep hearing some news from the other side of the city. It's really, really, those people are tiding. It's really hard for them to be under those people control. So I'm just praying for the moment when I would rather hear the statement that Mosul is entirely free.
And that was Muammar, who I spoke to a couple of hours ago, talking about his city of Mosul being liberated. We also had this message sent to us via WhatsApp from someone else in Mosul. Now, we got in touch with him through his son, Hassan. He's an Arsenal fan that we had on the programme a couple of weeks ago. And you'll hear Hassan's voice in English translate what his dad is saying in Arabic.
Dr. Ahmed Amar from the University of Mosul and the president of the teacher associations in the University of Mosul. Today I want to talk to you on the current situation of the city of Mosul. Many of them lost their families, houses and beloved ones. They are only living for hope. Many of them were suffered the torture from the ISIS militants. They lost their money, houses and lands. Until now, many of the liberated areas, the people still don't have their salaries back because the government refused to pay them the salary. Also, these salaries can bring back the life to the city because it will move the market to go up. Also, people are getting water from their wells. They don't have fresh water to drink from their houses. Furthermore, the aids are really rare there. People don't have any hospitals or places to go if they are sick. The last 2 years under ISIS command, people of Mosul really suffered difficult days. The ISIS tried to break out the community and divided it into different groups and to bring new ideologies to the people themselves. But the people of Mosul were still committed to their ideas and didn't affect simply by the ideas of the ISIS. Also, the people of Mosul are looking forward to the world.
And that was Ahmed and his son Hassan speaking to us from a recently liberated Mosul. You're listening to World Have Your Say. We've got around 15 minutes of the programme remaining. And for that time, we're going to talk about sickle cell disease. You may well have clicked on this story on the BBC News website throughout the day. A French teenager's sickle cell disease has been reversed after some pioneering treatment in France. They effectively changed his DNA. We're going to speak to someone who was involved in this study to talk to us about that technique. But first, let's speak to Janika, who is in Birmingham, which is the Midlands here in the UK, who lives with sickle cell disease. And Janika, you've also written a children's guide to it, I understand.
Yes, I've actually written a children's book on, it's just a little bit about sickle cell and how to stay well with the condition, which is called My Friend Jen.
Well, people listening around the world may not be familiar with this condition, how it affects you. So just explain to us how it affects you.
Basically, sickle cell, it affects the red blood cells. So instead of my cells being normal, round shaped, my sickle cells are actually half moon shaped. And what happens is these can clump together, cause blockages in arteries and veins, and it can be quite painful. And it's something known as a sickle cell crisis. And when this happens, it's, quite painful. You need to take pain medication or be hospitalised until the pain can go away.
When you say until the pain can go away, does it ever go away completely, or are you always living with some level of pain?
Well, I think for some sicklers, you'd always be living with some level of pain. It just depends what complications you have. I feel like I've had almost every complication going with sickle cell. One of the main ones was avascular necrosis, which I had in my hips, which was basically due to the blood not flowing to the top part of my hip bone. And as a result of that, my bone was decaying. I was living with constant pain. I was taking morphine every day. So that was a daily struggle for me until I actually had an operation to get my hip replaced.
Janika, stay with us, and I'm sure you've probably got questions for some of the guests who were involved in this study who we're going to speak to now. Professor Philippe Labouche from the University of Paris, an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and lead clinician on this study. Professor, thank you for taking the time out to speak with us. Just explain in simple terms, if you would, what exactly you've managed to achieve.
Well, first of all, your patient explained very nicely the nature of the disease. It comes from the aggregation, the abnormal aggregation of hemoglobin within red blood cells, and that's caused by a mutation in the gene for beta-globin. And what we did here is to find a way to inhibit the process of aggregation. So we actually used an amino acid residue, as we call it, from another globin that people have during fetal life. And that globin is a very strong inhibitor of aggregation in sickle cell disease. But we could not use it as is because it's, again, for fetuses, but not after birth. So we mimic the process within the normal beta-globin gene. And once we had made this modified gene, we put it in a vector to transfer the DNA information into the chromosome of the stem cells that make the blood. All the blood cells, red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets. So in practical terms, what we do, we harvest some of the bone marrow under brief anesthesia. Then we expose the cells from the marrow that we have prepared to the vector outside the body. And then we give a very brief chemotherapy with one medication for 4 days to eliminate the diseased stem cells which remain in the body. And then we inject the modified cells intravenously, and they home nicely to the bone, and they start making new blood. And this new blood, we hoped, and it appears to have been the case, no longer sickles, no longer aggregates.
So it appears to cure the condition.
Well, we don't like to use the word cure. As you know, we want to be very cautious not to give false hopes to patients. What we can say is that in this patient, for now approximately 2 years, the disease process has stopped. So as your patient explained again very nicely, the pain is no longer there. The patient was transfused continuously every month in order to dilute the abnormal hemoglobin to prevent pain and the other complications, and he's no longer transfused at all. And he had also hip replacement surgery in the past, and he has no longer any symptoms. And biologically, when we analyze the feature of the disease, we find that it is almost completely corrected. But again, it is one patient. We have to be cautious. We have to do more patients and follow up for a longer period of time. But it is encouraging.
So it looks, yeah, it looks positive at this stage. Wherever you're listening around the world, if you've got a question for the professor about sickle cell disease, then you can obviously tweet us using hashtag WHYS or message us on Facebook. Just search for BBC World Have Your Say. I want to bring in Elle Cole now, who's a mother of 8-year-old twins in Maryland. And Elle, your twins are affected by sickle cell disease.
Yes. I have two daughters, and one has sickle cell disorder, and the other one has the sickle cell trait.
So is what, effectively a carrier?
So, yes, one is a carrier. My husband and I are both carriers, so we had 25% chance of having a child who would be born with sickle cell. And it turns out that our twins are fraternal, and one does have the disorder.
And how does it affect them as 8-year-old girls who are probably wanting to run around with their friends and have fun?
Well, my daughter with the disorder, I actually homeschool her to kind of lessen the effect of her being around children who may have a lot of illnesses so that she doesn't get affected as much. So in her body, she's generally okay to look at her. She looks like a normal child. But what happens is sometimes she gets very tired and she has to constantly have fluids throughout the day. And so having her at home, she, you know, is able to do that when she needs to. So she's a typical little 8-year-old. She loves to play and have fun, but it definitely does affect her, especially in very cold weather or very hot weather. She's definitely more fatigued when the temperatures are at their extremest. So just having her and being able to teach her about living healthy and keeping her diet as plant-based as possible has really helped her not be severely affected. So she doesn't have a crisis often, which is good. And she's pretty healthy. Her fetal hemoglobin numbers are, she still has some, but for the most part, her hemoglobin is, you know, it's not the same as a regular child who doesn't have the disease, but she's doing pretty good for a child with sickle cell disorder. And she does have type SS, which, you know, there are different types of sickle cell disorders. So it's, you know, something that we should note that it's SS that she has.
I wonder, Elle, and also Janika, if you want to ask the professor who was involved, who's the lead clinician on this study and this work in Paris, if you have questions for him.
So, yes, I do have a question. I was very fascinated this morning when I heard the news about the teenager who has undergone the procedure. And I just wanted to know, just typically, I know that right now the disease is in, not the disease, the procedure is in a clinical trial state. How long does it take for, like, how many years do people typically have to go through a clinical trial in order for the market, for the hospitals and other medical fields to have access to the procedure to do them in other places?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a difficult question to answer because this therapy is new and still under study, as you understand, but also gene therapy by itself is a new approach, which seems to be more and more effective for more and more diseases as we go, but nevertheless, it is still a new field. So what I can tell you is that we are working very hard, and when I say we, I include also a biotech company in Boston, which is now global, the Bluebird Bio, which is the sponsor of the trial. As you know, we need a lot of money to carry out the clinical trials, to manufacture the product at high standards, etc. So they are pursuing both a trial on beta thalassemia, which is a very similar disease, meaning that it's quite different. However, it's the same gene that is affected, and sickle cell disease. And they are a bit more advanced in the number of patients they did in beta thalassemia. So they are using our vector, the same vector, and they treated over 20 patients now with beta thalassemia. And that's global, both in the US, in Europe, in Australia, and Thailand. And for sickle cell disease, there are 7 patients that have been treated in the US with the same vector, but we don't have yet results from that because it's a bit early. So the only thing I can tell you is that everything is made so that we move as fast as possible, and we need to build a case for the regulatory agencies, obviously, that the procedure is warranted for patients. It's beneficial. The risk is very low, or is actually extremely small. That's what we want to see. But once we have demonstrated this, we hope that it would be available to more and more patients. So in other words, we have to be cautious, but we do everything we can to move this fast.
Let's talk about money now, because Dennis in Kenya has tweeted us a question saying, this is the best news ever, medication on sickle cell disease. The progress is looking promising, but how much will it cost? Let's bring in Steve Hyde, who's Associate Professor of Molecular Therapy at John Radcliffe Hospital at the University of Oxford. Steve Hyde, I know you've not been involved in this study, but I know this is an area that you understand well. Cost-wise, presumably hugely expensive.
Well, it's very difficult to judge. I wouldn't want to predict a cost for Bluebird Bio ultimately, but I think it's helpful to compare it to the cost of another medicine which has recently come to the market. So there is a similar disease. It's called X-SCID. It's treated in a similar way. Drug for that has recently been approved, and the price for a treatment in Europe is of the order of 600,000 euros. So obviously that's an astonishingly large amount of money per patient. In the context of X-SCID, that's probably manageable by the health services around the world because there aren't very many people who suffer from that disease, fortunately. For sickle cell, obviously, it's a much, much more common disorder. It's the most common genetic disease in the world. And I would imagine that that sort of price tag would cause enormous problems for the health services to deliver it. On the plus side, though, at the moment, it's at the early stages of development. I'm sure that as Professor LaBush, who I must congratulate on a brilliant study and an excellent paper, has alluded to, that Bluebird Bio are trying to scale up their manufacturing, and that will be the key to reducing the cost to a place where it's manageable.
Right. If I may add a word here, you have to know also that the average cost of care per year in the United States for a sickle cell patient is between $15,000 and $20,000. And that's a cost for society in the US that is approximately $1 billion a year. And for the treatment by gene therapy, as our colleague explained, a part of it is very similar to allogeneic bone marrow transplantation, which is now becoming a standard of care in the West, meaning Europe and the United States, mostly for thalassemia, but also for sickle cell disease. And it's only when there's no available intrafamilial compatible donor, which is for 3/4 or 2/3 of patients, that gene therapy at this stage would be warranted. And if you look at the cost of gene therapy added to the cost of transplantation, it is not that high. And it's, as our colleague said, it will also come down the way computer costs went down dramatically with automation and ways of producing the vector in a better and faster and greater way.
Do you forgive me for jumping in? We've only got a couple of minutes of the programme left, and I know that Janika had a question that she wanted to pose. Go ahead, Janika.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, what is the process for sickle cell patients to volunteer for the trials? Like, how do they... I know that you mentioned a couple of countries, you know, global, but none were... I didn't hear you mention any in the UK. What would that process be?
Right. Well, I think the best way would be to go through Bluebird Bio, Chief Medical Officer, and his colleagues. because that's the way they sort through patients who may benefit or may be enrolled in one trial or another, knowing that there are several centers now, even though it's the same vector and protocol. So I think that I would recommend to do it that way. And later on, you know, if it opens more widely, then it would be other means also to get in. But at this stage, I would say that's the best way.
Okay, thank you.
And a question I want to put
to you. I could send you off, you know, I could put you in touch with them.
That would be excellent, yeah.
We can sort that out off air, no problem at all. Agnes in Nairobi has tweeted saying, does this study look at trying to prohibit gene mutations of people who are carriers of sickle cell? So are you looking at prevention or is this literally looking at attempting to cure?
Well, at this stage, it is attempting to cure, you know, for ethical reasons and other reasons that, you know, I could list. The first approach is really to tackle a disorder in patients who have it. You know, one patient out of 13 among African-Americans carry the gene. So it's very, very common in some populations, 45% in some parts of Uganda. So we are not attempting to do anything there. We're just attempting to do something beneficial to patients who have the disease.
And Steve Hyde, briefly before the end of the programme, do you see this as a significant step forward?
It's a marvellous piece of science and medicine coming together. I mean, Professor LaButch has been incredibly modest. The impact on the patient has been revolutionary. I'm sure it will have made an enormous difference to the quality of their life. And if that can be expanded out to more and more sickle cell patients, I'm sure that will be greatly appreciated by the community.
Steve Hyde, thank you very much for coming onto the programme. Also, Professor Philippe LaButch, who was a lead clinician on this study. And it's also great to hear from Janika and also from Elle, two people who live with sickle cell disease and the effects that it has on them and their family. That's all we've got time for on this edition of the programme. Don't forget, if you've missed any of World Have Your Say, you can always download our podcast. You can listen back to anything that you have missed. Just search for BBC World Have Your Say on your internet search engine and you will find us. Thanks for your company today. I'll speak to you again on Monday. Drop.